This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Like any good writer, Ayad Akhtar writes about what he knows, and he knows what it's like to be a Muslim in America. But his sometimes unflattering depictions have angered many of his fellow Muslim Americans. The main character in his debut novel is a Pakistani-American boy growing up in Milwaukee. Ayad also was once a Pakistani-American boy growing up in Milwaukee. Today he's a screenwriter, a playwright, an actor, and a novelist living in New York. The book is called American Dervish. He's going to read tonight at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh, tomorrow The Regulator in Durham, here now in our studio. Ayad Akhtar, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Ayad Akhtar, welcome to the State of Things. I wanted to correct that. So in a lot of ways, I could be reductive and say it's a coming-of-age story, it's about Muslim-American experience, it's that and more. Tell us why you chose to write this, and this was your first novel.
I wanted to write a book about the American religious experience. Religion is an important part, it has always been an important part of my life in terms of what I've thought about and also in terms of how I've experienced life. And I wanted to write a story that was going to I think that something about the American experience, religion is central to that. You know, it's often discussed, this sort of post-Enlightenment, French-inspired, tradition that inspired our founding fathers, which is basically a secularist movement. But what is given short shrift, I think, in the American historical and ideological experience is the fact that the country was founded by religious extremists, basically, you know. So religion is an important part of our makeup, and for both wondrous and, you know, we couldn't imagine the civil rights movement without Southern black church experience, and also for some of the things that are more destructive in our national history. So I wanted to write a book that was going to give form and shape and color to the American religious experience from a Muslim point of view.
It seems to me it's also fraught. It's a difficult position to write from, given the rise of Islamophobia, the pressure on Muslims in America today, to write about that experience sort of in the abstract, and you don't do that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the one way of circumventing it was setting the book 20 years before 9/11. So, it gave me the freedom to write about an immigrant community and a group of characters that were not necessarily politicized by their environment, though I was fully aware that people reading it today were going to politicize it. That said, it's something that comes up a lot is, I get the question a lot because there aren't a lot of prominent sort of Muslim American, artists out there in terms of getting visibility. There's some wonderful artists out there, but they don't have as much visibility. And so when somebody like myself comes along and has a book that gets sort of, gets a lot of attention, there's this sense that I have a responsibility to, represent the faith in some contrary way to which it is being discussed and whatnot. And I didn't preoccupy myself in writing the book with how people are talking or thinking about Islam. I preoccupied myself with telling a story that was true to my experience.
Will you read for us? Maybe you can set this up for
us.
Yeah,
for sure. The book is basically about a young man named Hayat Shah between the ages of 10 and 12, and he is he's a kid of secular Muslim parents and lives in a kind of a dour household. His mom and his dad are constantly at each other's throats. And into this dour sort of household arrives this wonderful presence, Mina Ali. And she's a beautiful, brilliant Pakistani woman who has come here to sort of flee a terrible divorce back in Pakistan and rebuild her life. She opens up so much to the boy. And one of the things that starts to happen is she ends up in a courtship with his father's best friend, Nathan Wolfson, who's a doctor at the local hospital. And so the section I'm going to read to you now is where Hayat and his mother, Munir, who's a housewife but has studied psychology, are talking about what's going on between Mina and Nathan. Nathan is Jewish. You need to know that for this little section. They're lying in bed. Mom has come in to check on Hayat. So, is everything okay with Mina, auntie? I finally asked. She's good, Beta. A little confused, but good. Why is she confused? Things are getting serious. Things? For once your father did an honorable thing. He told Nathan he should figure out his intentions. Things can't go on like this forever. After all, Mina is an Eastern girl. Mother paused, shaking her head ever so slightly, a wistful wetness in her eyes. You know what that sweet man said. No.
that he considered himself lucky she's been so open with him. He didn't expect she would agree to see him the way she has, and he's grateful. He's such a sensitive man, so intelligent. I really don't know why he is so close to your father. What do they say, opposites attract, like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde? That's supposed to be the same person. Hmm? Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde are the same person, I think. Don't be cheeky. My point is, Nathan is a good man. That's what matters. That's what I keep telling her, and a good man is hard to find. I mean, she doesn't need to be told that. She's seen it firsthand in her own life, and she sees it here in this house every day. Mother was still running her fingers along my forehead. She's worried because he's Jewish. And of course, there's Imran, too, who keeps telling her he doesn't want a white father, but that's nonsense. She can't make a decision about something like that because of what a 5-year-old is saying. Mother paused, drawing her hand away as she looked off. Now she's fixated on the fact that the man's a Jew, and what will people back home say, and what will the children be, Muslim or Jewish? I keep telling her she shouldn't be so worried about that kind of thing, but she's headstrong, just fixated. She chuckled, adding almost more to herself than me. Dr. Freud would have written quite a case study about your Mina, auntie. Now Mother turned to me again, a sudden light in her eyes. I keep telling her the fact that Nathan's Jewish is a good thing. They understand how to respect women better. They understand how to let a woman be a woman. They understand how to give a woman attention. I told Mina auntie he will give her a life she can never dream of with a Muslim man. Muslim men are terrified of women, all of them. She leaned in, kissing me on the nose, her face just inches from mine, her soulful eyes swollen with abounding love. That's why I'm bringing you up differently, so that you learn how to respect a woman. That's the truth, Qurban. I'm bringing you up like a little Jew.
Ayad Akhtar, his debut novel, The American Dervish. And reading that section, of course, we get a hint at some of what goes on in this novel and some of why you have received these criticisms about you not representing well enough. There is anti-Semitism, there is stereotype from Muslims about Jews. We have alcoholic Muslims in here, unflattering portraits of Muslims at a time when you're being pressed as a visible artist to represent.
I take issue with the characterization of them as unflattering portraits. I think that they're full portraits of people that are human and struggling with the sorts of things that we all struggle with. And I think that because they're not binary representations, and because they do have flaws, that, you know, and everybody in the book is flawed, that therefore the representations can be misconstrued, I think, as negative. And they're not. I mean, the thing that I've been touring around the country, I've done 30 cities at this point with the book, and the thing that readers, I feel, take away from the book by and large is a sense of loving the characters and falling in love with the world that the book presents them with. Understanding that those characters are deeply flawed and at times struggling with the choices that they make and the things that they do. But as we would with anyone that we know, really, that we truly know. So anyway.
Yeah, no, it's the Simpsons effect. Now I've reduced your novel to a cartoon, you see. No.
Yeah.
But the idea that...
That's good company. Though.
That
Simpsons
is good company. No, that's wonderful company. Your book should be on the bestseller list so long. But the other beautiful thing about the book, and I think it's part of the same fabric, is this coming of age. It's about religion. It's about the awakening to religious experience from a mentor who is an older woman, a young man, and the way religious ecstasy is conflated with romantic passion in a young man growing up in a culture that's perhaps somewhat exotic to him. He's a Muslim in an American culture.
Right.
All of these beautiful things so beautifully rendered in the book.
Well, thank you. You know, that's one of the great enduring themes of, you know, sort of the relationship of the sexual, you know, to the spiritual. And you know, in the Sufi tradition, you know, there's a long history of what are commonly known as right path techniques versus left path techniques with regards to mystical practice. Right path techniques in basically sort of mirror or replicate the brain chemistry of deep sleep in order to induce higher states of awareness. And left path techniques sort of mimic or attempt to recreate the brain chemistry of sexuality to induce higher states of awareness. And the Sufi tradition is notoriously left path. I mean, you can see it in the dominant metaphors, which are union with the beloved, and the drunken ecstasy, which are left path techniques. The book is playing with those themes and playing with the union with the beloved as a way to figure the experience of the divine.
And is that the dervish in American Dervish, the reference to Sufi?
There's a few different mentions of dervish, and there's a you know, reflection on the thematic of what dervishes are. Dervish in the Muslim tradition, I think it's commonly misunderstood to be the monks in Turkey who whirl. Those are whirling dervishes, but there are also dervishes who don't whirl. There are dervishes who, as monks, you know, in the Christian tradition, there's some trained dogs and some who, you know, make beer, and there are dervishes who do all sorts of things. So a dervish is basically a renunciate, somebody who's renounced the life of the world for God.
And there's also – your protagonist also has these – in any religious awakening, there is the moment of recognition where you recognize the hypocrisy in the dominant culture and the dominant religion. Nobody really practices the way I've just learned it. Right.
Right.
A beautiful chapter in there where he starts to count the number of years his father's going to spend in hell by the drink.
Yeah, right? That's right. That's always a tradition of, you know, 70 years in hell for a sip. So
yeah, it's and but this is also, again, the coming of age, the recognition, the pain, I guess, of coming to believe piously and passionately in this tradition, and then looking around at the practitioners in your immediate family and saying, well, nobody does this.
What's the story of faith? The story of faith is invariably a story of doubt as well. That's, and I think that's one of the things that folks don't necessarily associate with Islam for whatever reason. I think there's this sense perhaps that Muslims have a kind of faith that makes them inured to doubt. And, you know, again, the book is about religious experience and therefore is very much about doubt as well.
Well, that's because we hear most from, because they command the most attention, the fundamentalist in any religion, Christian fundamentalist, would suggest they have no doubt either about how many years the earth has been here and, you know, sort of how many sins you can commit before you can, et cetera.
And yet I think in examined life, even within the context of evangelical Christianity or, you know, sort of extreme sort of fundamentalist persuasions of any faith, the story of doubt is there. It's just not necessarily told. But it's there.
You had a profound moment of doubt as a writer when your first attempt in school at writing was praised, and this for some reason disturbed you. Tell us that story.
I grew up as a kid. Sort of, my parents are both doctors, and they had sort of inculcated me to sort of repeat like an automaton that I would become a neurosurgeon when I grew up. Didn't really know what that was. And then I had an amazing teacher in high school who sort of changed my life. She was a lit teacher, made me want to become a writer. Read a lot. And then I got to college and took a creative writing class and wrote a story in that class. It was the first short story I wrote. And my teacher calls me into his office and says, I think it's the finest short story I've read by a student. And I definitely think you have a good shot at being published. I know the editors at The Atlantic and The New Yorker, and here are their addresses, and please send it. I don't know that you'll get published, but I think there's a good chance you will. You know, I was obviously overjoyed, but I was profoundly ill at ease. I didn't know where the story had come from. I didn't know how I had done it. And I was concerned. I was terrified that if people wanted me to do it again, I wouldn't know how to, and I wouldn't know. So I never sent the story. And ended up falling into this kind of depression and, you know, dropping all my classes and sort of dropping out of school basically for a little while. And had a friend who, you know, was doing theater and sort of got me involved in theater as a way to get me out of myself. And that led me back to school and back into a whole different career, which is, you know, something that I also do.
You know, Ed, most people quit school when people tell them they're no good. they actually stay when people tell them they're doing a good job. So that's a little contrary. Well, what do you think it was about acting that brought you back to the arts or to school?
You know, I think in the case of, you know, I think why it had that effect on me was that I wasn't prepared to be seen, I think. You know, I think I kind of grew up in a house where I wasn't really seen, and I wasn't ready for that at all. I was conditioned by a whole different way of being. And I think I also, as I said earlier, I didn't know where it had come from, and I think there was some wisdom in that. I was very young, and I didn't know that I had much to write about. And I think that to me, one of the great things that's happened to me is that because I went through so much difficulty as a young writer, I ended up having to live life and to do things that had nothing to do with writing, and I didn't write about those things, and I didn't begin to practice this sort of self-awareness of experiencing things and then writing about them, which I think just gives my writing practice a completely different focus. It's more focused on the world than it is on me.
How do you do it? Do you know now? And is that helpful to you to know how you do it?
Well, I've been, you know, as I've been a working writer now for a while. I mean, I worked in the film industry and wrote 9 screenplays and, you know, made a living basically for half a decade doing that, and learned a lot about story and learned a lot about what it means to tell a story, which is a very different sort of perspective than writing out of a place of wanting to express yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not to give short shrift to that. To me, writing in the artistic act is about an engagement with the world, an engagement with what's out there, as opposed to an expression of who I am.
So how is it different? You've done screenwriting, you've written plays as well. This is your first published novel. Fundamentally different than the other kind of writing?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's a rigor of story that's required when you're dealing with a live audience. I mean, you can just tell when they're starting to lose interest. And I just, you know, it's painful when an audience starts losing interest. So it's basically self-preservation that forces you to become a better storyteller. And I think with a novel, there's so much more space and expansiveness. There's more opportunity for this kind of very intimate relationship with the reader, this entering into their interior space. And there isn't perhaps as much of a premium, at least in literary fiction, on making the story move. And so I think that that's something that I have been sensitive to and aware of. And I think at times, perhaps, you know, as I grow as a novelist, I think I might cut myself more slack and allow myself a little bit more space because I'm so conditioned by the dramatic storytelling structure.
Well, what does that add to the novel? Why would that be better to sort of take that space? What does it do in the novel that it?
I think it allows it. You know, as a novelist, you're responsible for creating a world. When you're a screenwriter, you're responsible for creating a blueprint that a director, a group of actors, and designers will then create a world from. So the novelist, in a way, is all of those people, and there's a kind of a patience in the process and a patience that's demanded of the reader in order to be able to bring that off. And so I think that that's something that, you know, again, coming from the dramatic arts and coming from writing for the theater and writing for film, it's a difference that I'm still learning.
So I read in this New York Times piece that you have a chair in your apartment where your characters sit.
You're pulling all the stops out here.
I work hard to get ready for this show. We're going to let it all out. Don't take it all out. Leave it all on the field.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. I have some odd writer's rituals, which were sort of paraded in the New York Times.
The chair. So you got a chair.
Yeah, I have a chair, which, you know, it's an empty space, and it's an empty space that gets designated for a character, and I will let that presence just be in the room with me for a period of time. It'll gradually seem to take on some kind of valence, some shape, some form, some feeling, and then I'll sit in the chair when the time is right, and a lot of times I will begin to discover things about that character. It's a shamanic sort of, you know, thing.
I wish I had more time to ask you how you came to that, but I realize now I'm out of time. So thank you for sharing that.
It's been a pleasure.
Great to talk with you. Ead Akhtar, author of American Dervish, going to be reading tonight, 7:30, Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh. Tomorrow, 7 o'clock, The Regulator in Durham. Just ahead, how you bend a stick without breaking it. Stay tuned to The State of Things.